Hello, my name is Matthew Osborne. Up until the outbreak of the coronavirus, I was known by many simply as that drummer in Johnny Kowalski and the Sexy Weirdos. It was not the coronavirus, however, that led to my departure from the band. I was due to play my last show with them on March the 14th in any case. 10 years is a long time to be doing anything, I thought. As it turned out, this would be the last show any of us would play for a still unknowable period of time. The Sexy Weirdos have been forced to cancel their upcoming European tour. These tours, in some circles at least, became the stuff of legend. As I sit here today in isolation, I find myself looking back fondly on 10 years of unbelievable gigs. From the ruins of a castle in the hills overlooking fair Verona, to an abandoned fortress town in the Czech Republic, each one was unique. To commemorate these often magical experiences, I began writing about them in an as yet unfinished memoir. I'd like to read some extracts from this and play a few tracks from our latest album, Until the Day, which is available now through Bandcamp. Chapter 1, The Monte Carlo Bank Job. The plan was very simple because it wasn't a very good plan and we hadn't thought it through well at all. It was conceived in the cockpit of our LDV convoy during one of the many idiotic conversations Jonjo and I had there. These conversations were frequently tinged with a madness forged from the dust and grime of hundreds of miles of forgetful road. As the only two drivers on the tour, we swapped driving duties and kept each other awake and focused with dumb voices, inane jokes and stupid ideas. Staying awake was important because we had a timetable to fulfil and many thousands of miles to travel. Rests were a hindrance to the schedule, and the responsibility for the safety of ourselves and three other wacky English proletariat idiots often loomed large as the dark descended and the roads became indistinguishable from dreams. We had affectionately named the van Crystal after the Doors song The Crystal Ship. We had torn up her insides to be able to seat and sleep five comfortably. One of us, usually me, could stretch out across the front seats. The gear stick and handbrake proved niggling obstacles which never allowed maximum comfort to be obtained, but the partition it provided me from the rest of the sweaty, smelly guys and their night noises was well worth the hardship. Two of us could sleep on the shelf at the back of the bus on a mattress which was suspended by crude carpentry above our equipment. Simon preferred this bed, but his size and overbearingly guttural snoring meant that the rest of us would frequently fight over who didn't get to spend the night tucked up close to him. We would spend a lot of our time conjuring up uncharacteristically altruistic reasons why someone else deserved the spot more. Jonjo, by contrast, was the smallest member of the group and a seemingly good choice of bed buddy. However, once he took off his shoes, the smell could be quite overwhelming. This meant that a top-to-toe sleeping arrangement was not an option. Consequently, it would not be unusual to wake up in the mornings to discover someone tightly spooning Jonjo, finding an odd comfort from the night terrors in his bony and brittle body. A third bed was made of the one row of seats we had screwed into the midsection of the vehicle. The pitfall of this bed was a gap approximately where one's arse would normally nestle. During the night, this gap would slowly suck a slumberer through it, and they would frequently be awoken in agony and forced to unfold themselves. Despite this, Chris tended to favour this spot, even though he was the tallest and most foldable of our little group. The fifth sleeping position was the floor space, of which there was plenty due to the removal of most of the seats in the bus. The obvious downside to this option was that it provided no padding nor comfort to the sleeper, and the empty bolt holes let in cold air. Despite this, Johnny was a quiet fan of the floor. His years of squatted living had hardened his body against such discomfort, and his habit for being the last to bed down meant that it suited him not to disturb the rest of us. Although Crystal was a suitable home for the 5 weeks or so of our tour, she remained untested as a battering ram or getaway vehicle, and this was really her only role in the plan we had concocted to rob a bank in one of the richest parts of Europe, Monaco, on the glamorous French Riviera. To her credit, Crystal had demonstrated a tough exterior following a frightening incident in Paris a few days earlier. As we had rolled slowly into the city on one of the fatty arteries which feeds vehicles crammed with angry passengers into the heart of the sprawling French capital, a gang of street kids had started to clean our windscreen despite our protestations and pleas for them not to. We were on our way to our first show of the tour, a small dungeon in the basement of a pokey cafe called La Barricade, and had no euros until we had got paid that evening. We tried our best to explain this with the pathetic little French we had, but to no avail. I tried to fend them off using the windscreen wipers and washer jets. Still, they persevered and got the job done, and then angrily demanded payment. We offered them some English coins and a few Czech coronas that we found in the glove box, relics from a previous adventure. This only helped to infuriate them further. Johnny took a couple of angry blows to the head and frantically wound up the passenger's side window before they could grab him by the neck. We were stuck in traffic and I couldn't manoeuvre Crystal away from the relentless blows which they inflicted upon her exterior. Eventually, a thick-set and grisly Parisian got out of his car further along the jam and shouted a few words at them, which sent them running back beneath the underpass. Crystal was robust, we had proven that, but her speed was something that couldn't be counted upon. The hills that rise up and into Monaco are steep, and the roads that thread through them narrow and winding. I had been at the wheel again the day before when we tried to pass an enthusiastic cyclist. He kept pace with Crystal on the uphill stretch, legs pumping like the pistons of some hideous juggernaut, calved muscles all sinewy and intimidating, and his bum crack visibly dampened from the exertion. I became convinced that he was racing us and taking delight in his triumph. I couldn't take him on the downhill stretches either, and these were few and far between. The cyclist Detron frequently strayed away from the roadside, and the meandering nature of the roads meant that I was throwing the other passengers around each time I tried to take him on one of the many treacherous bends. This caused Simon to shout at me hysterically and beg for me to slow down as he became visibly frightened by the sheer drops into the overbearingly blue Mediterranean Ocean to the right of us. Eventually, on a relatively flat stretch of road with a good deal of dry scrubland on either side of the carriageway, I managed to ease past the cyclist, but he remained in my rearview mirror for many minutes afterwards, like the indestructible cyborg assassin from the future in Terminator.